Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And we're extremely fortunate today. We're actually traveling a little bit out of our normal circuit and normal state lines. Our guest today is Judge Robert Bacharach from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And Judge Bacharach, thank you so much for joining us today. We're thrilled to have you.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
And you're coming to us, I think, from Oklahoma. Is that right?
That's right. Oklahoma City.
Well, we've had a couple of over the Red River guests, but we're really glad to have another one joining us. Judge, if you would, maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of your background.
Jody, I graduated law school in 1985. And upon graduation, I clerked for 2 years for Judge Holloway, who was a judge in the 10th Circuit with chambers in Oklahoma City. And then in 1987, I went to work in litigation for a firm in Oklahoma, Crow and Dunleavy, until 1999. And I was appointed then to be a U.S. magistrate judge in the Western District of Oklahoma. I served there for almost 14 years until 2013, when I was appointed to the 10th Circuit, and have been here ever since.
You don't mind spending a few minutes? I feel like I know, I mean, I've been before federal magistrate judges, and I kind of understand, but I don't know that I've really ever had the chance to kind of hear one talk about the job and their experience. I know it's a little different than a federal district judge. I'd really appreciate your perspective on kind of what it's like and what magistrates do.
You bet, Jody. And that's not uncommon. Very few people really know a lot about the position of being a magistrate judge. But and one of the wonderful things about the magistrate judge system is that Congress created this mechanism to have federal judges throughout the country, and they would do different kinds of things in each district court that are particularly suited to the caseload in that district. For example, if you have a lot of prisoner cases, hypothetically, let's say in Dallas, the magistrate judges may concentrate on prisoner cases. And in another district, say in Alabama, where there may be relatively few prisoners for that population, they may do very little of that kind of work. So it really varies from district to district. Where I am here in Oklahoma City, there was and is a very heavy prison population. So we spent a lot of time dealing with prisoner cases. We dealt a lot with Social Security disability appeals. And this is relatively common throughout the country, Jody. We conducted a lot of settlement conferences, basically of mediation. And apart from that, we would take a delegation from the district judges of a variety of discovery motions, discovery issues, and really ran the gamut about what would be assigned.
Could parties consent to a trial before you as a U.S. magistrate? I hear of that happening around here a fair amount.
It varies so much, Todd, court to court, and it really depends a lot on the tradition in that jurisdiction. So there are some, it is becoming far more common, really, throughout the country for more and more parties to consent to trial by a magistrate judge. One of the things that will affect that is how heavy the caseload is. For example, there are some federal districts in California that just have unbelievable caseloads. And so you can imagine if you're one of the parties in one of these very heavy litigated districts where you have to wait years to go to trial, there's a lot of incentive to consent to trial by a magistrate judge if that means that you're going to get in quicker and get your day in court. There are federal judges that conduct the trial very ably. And so that's one of the variables that will affect how often the parties consent.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
It seems like, from a practical perspective, a magistrate judge would be maybe a little bit more public-facing and public interacting than even a federal district judge, because you just have so many different things and initial appearances and things that maybe come before you that maybe a federal judge doesn't even have.
That's very true, Jody. When I became a magistrate judge, one of the things that I did was to talk to other more experienced magistrate judges and really get their suggestions about the job. And I will never forget, this is going back now over 20 years, Jody. One of the things that a relatively new, but she had more experience than I had, magistrate judge said that in her view, one of the most important responsibilities that she had was conducting arraignments and initial appearances. And that struck me as so interesting and counterintuitive, because that's one of the few things that a judge really has very little discretion to make any decisions at all. It's primarily to give an advisement of rights to the accused, and in the case of an arraignment, to take a plea of not guilty, because magistrate judges cannot accept guilty pleas in felony cases. So you can accept a guilty plea in a misdemeanor, but not in a felony case. And so I asked about that, and she said, when you conduct an initial appearance or an arraignment, it is the very first time that that individual who is now has his or her liberty in jeopardy will see a federal judge. May not be the federal judge that's going to conduct their trial, but they're not going to draw these kinds of distinctions. What they want to know is this process going to treat me fairly? Are the judges going to treat me civilly? Are they going to just assume that I'm guilty and treat me as such? And I was so glad that she told me that, because I vividly remember that and really tried my best to remember that for every initial appearance and arraignment I had. And that's, I think, indicative of what you're talking about, Jody. Magistrate judges are on the front lines. In the civil context, when we conducted settlement conferences, one of the wonderful things about conducting settlement conferences is that you get a lot more exposure to the parties. For example, you might have a product liability case where the plaintiff may testify and get exposed to the jury for an hour, a couple of hours. And frequently, I would spend the better part of a day with that individual. And they wouldn't be restricted, obviously, to talking to me about what's admissible and what's inadmissible. Mm-hmm. They may talk about their family, what their aspirations from the case are, or what the litigation has meant to them personally, emotionally. And you have people in tears frequently people that would be able to vent to me about their frustration, maybe with the other party, maybe with me, maybe with their lawyer, maybe with their family members. It was such an intensely personal set of interactions that it was a dimension that the public typically, and lawyers typically, don't see. And it was just really extraordinary. It just truly was.
The settlement conference thing is just something that you don't see with trial judges. Jody and I both practice in state court here in Texas a lot. We have a very well-established mediation bar. And so our trial judges in state court don't really participate in settlement conferences. But I've been involved with a few with U.S. magistrates, and it is a very interesting process. You do feel like you're in chambers with the judge, you know, or maybe the conference is being held somewhere else. But it's interesting to hear the judicial perspective, you know, on issues that you could legitimately discuss with the parties as far as the risks and potential rewards of taking their case to trial. And when you, unless they've consented to trial before you, the magistrate, you know, you wouldn't be the judge sitting and making those rulings. So I guess that's one thing that makes that work, is that the magistrate is not usually going to be the one that would be actually trying the case.
That's exactly right. And in our court, different courts have different, and different judges have different philosophies about this, Todd. In our court, it was the case, and I'm confident it still is the case, that if you were going to be the trial judge in a consent case, that someone else, another magistrate judge, would conduct that settlement conference. And I think that that was very, very important so that parties knew that there was nothing that they, if they expressed stubbornness to me as the settlement judge, they knew that that wasn't going to come back to haunt them in any way. They could be completely candid. And what that also did was take the judge out of his or her judicial role. I never wore a robe in a settlement conference. I very infrequently used my office. I would go to where they are and, you know, and sit in their room. And you are acting as a judge in a sense, but in a real sense, you're working as a facilitator and as a confidant and as someone, being an ally is the wrong word, because obviously you're not an ally for either of the party, but you are an ally toward the concept of settlement, trying to bridge those differences. But one of the things that was difficult for me as a settlement judge is you sometimes will have a strongly held belief that the parties will be better off in settlement. And sometimes it's difficult, but it's important to remember that if the parties want to go to trial, it really is their decision. And even though you're a judge, you can't and shouldn't press too hard, because you do have an influence that a private mediator may not have. And so that is very important as well.
Super interesting. So you went from that appointment in 99, I guess you served about 5 years as a U.S. magistrate judge, and then you were fortunate enough to be appointed to the 10th Circuit in, I think you said, 2014?
In 2013, and I was a magistrate judge for a little longer than that. I was a magistrate judge for almost 14 years.
Oh, I'm sorry. I may have to edit that. My math is so bad.
Doing math is a dangerous game.
I think I'll re-ask the question because my math is so bad.
I went to law school. But, you know, and partly why I mentioned that, Todd, is, you know, I was so blessed to get appointed as a magistrate judge. I had no idea that I would even be seriously considered. In fact, when I interviewed with the committee, my wife and I, we went on a trip, and someone said, well, what if you get called back to interview before the district judges? And I said, the district judges aren't going to give me an interview. And so my wife and I were in Las Vegas when I got a call, and got a call at 6 o'clock in the morning, because it was 8 o'clock in Oklahoma, and in a groggy voice, I answered the phone. But it was just a wonderful opportunity and a wonderful job. And I can truthfully say, Todd, that I enjoyed every single day of those almost 14 years. It was just really wonderful. And I had such great colleagues.
Well, I sure didn't mean to short you on your time of service, Judge. But now you've made that transition and you've been sitting on the 10th Circuit now for, gosh, I guess about 7 years.
A little bit more, but yeah.
So tell us about the nomination and confirmation process to the 10th Circuit. We've had a few federal judges on our show, and some have offered more information than others, and we're sensitive that, you know, some of that is sort of inside baseball. But tell us what you can tell us about what it was like to go through once you got the nomination.
Well, it was such a surreal process, Todd. I never expected to be seriously considered as a magistrate judge, and I certainly never thought I would be seriously considered for the circuit judgeship. And I didn't have any political ties. I really didn't know any of the representatives. I didn't know either of our senators, a lifelong Democrat living in a state where all of the representatives, I believe at the time, were Republican. Our two senators were Republican. And we had a Democratic governor who was really the only powerful Democratic office holder in the state. And I knew who he was, but a little beyond that. And somehow I got selected, and I learned later, after I was nominated, that I met with Dr. Coburn, one of the two U.S. senators, with Senator Inhofe, and he told me that he would support me. And I was so ecstatic, Todd, because Dr. Coburn had said no to quite a few people. I was not President Obama's first pick or his second pick. I was his third pick, and he had said no to a lot of judicial nominees from Oklahoma. And so I was ecstatic, and I called the White House counsel's office and said, Dr. Coburn said that he would support me. And they said, well, that's good. And I thought, did I wake you guys up? You know, why aren't you as excited as I am? And they said, well, to be honest with you, Bob, we're not surprised because that's how President Obama got your name in the first place. And I had never known that. I found it difficult to get a meeting with Dr. Coburn. I never was able to meet with him until after I was nominated. And I said, how is it that you guys forgot to tell me that? You know, I would have had a lot less anxiety meeting with him. You all had shared that little tidbit of information. And they said, well, we just, to the administration's credit, they took vetting to a whole new level. Their explanation was, we didn't want to short circuit the process. We didn't know if you would be a good nominee or not. And so he gave us your name, and then we went and vetted you, which they certainly did. And so it was very odd. Dr. Coburn ended up being, of course, he's deceased now, but I never voted for Dr. Coburn. I disagreed with his politics, and he didn't care one bit. He didn't care what I thought politically. And he said, and I share all of this, I certainly wouldn't share this publicly if he hadn't shared it publicly, but he had said publicly, he told me privately that he supported me because he was convinced that I would do what I thought the law required and that I wouldn't let my personal ideology influence me. And he also told me privately, and I heard, and again, I wouldn't share this, but for the fact that I had heard him say this publicly on the floor of the Senate, that if Governor Romney had beat President Obama in 2012, he was still going to recommend me to President Romney. There were a President Romney, knowing that there would be a Republican administration, there would be two Republican senators, and they certainly didn't need to pick a lifelong Democrat that position. So, you know, it's whatever one thinks of Dr. Coburn's politics, he was quite extraordinary.
That's a great story to hear when so many of the headlines are about political divisions, to hear about someone that was, you know, an exemplary character in that respect.
It really is, Jody. And at the time, of course, we all thought that the politics were sort of had crossed the line, and in retrospect, it's just become so much more polarizing in Washington. Mm-hmm. And perhaps, you know, we just need, you know, more people like that that do, you know, that, of course, the representatives and senators are going to have strongly held political beliefs. But, you know, we should be uniformly trying to select judges who try to follow the law. And really, it shouldn't matter what a judge thinks politically, because it's horrible to have, you know, the idea that any judge is going to let his or her political beliefs influence their judicial decision making. That's just not supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm. Certainly undermines the whole confidence in the judicial branch. So how was the process, having been a magistrate on the trial level for so long, transitioning over to the appellate court?
It was so different. One of the things that federal judges do in common, regardless of the position, is research and write and edit. Of course, and all of that was much the same. We did have, I did acquire a far more diverse type of caseload. All of a sudden, I wasn't just dealing with Social Security disability appeals or prisoner cases. I was dealing with the whole wide range of types of cases. And frankly, that's just been one of the exhilarating parts of this position, is just being able to learn so much about areas of the law that I know nothing about and knew nothing about. So that has been different. And what the most tangible difference is, when you become a circuit judge, all of a sudden you have no power whatsoever. If you ask me for a 1 hour extension of time, I can't grant you a 1 hour extension of time. And I convince one of my colleagues that, oh, you know, Jody just wants an extra hour. And, but you know, if two of my colleagues say, no, Jody doesn't deserve an extra hour, I can't even do that by myself. You can't do anything. That's why there was he's deceased now, a wonderful, wonderful man. His name was Lee West. He was a district judge here. He was sort of legendary. And he used to always tease that circuit judges are okay as long as they're not, you know, like in Noah's Ark, as long as there's just one of them. You know, one circuit judge is okay, but you put two circuit judges together and there's nothing but trouble.
It does. That reminds me. Oh, go ahead, Todd. Sorry.
I'm sorry. That reminds me of stories I've heard about other courts and some of what I've seen, that there is more, I don't want to call it lobbying, maybe I call it persuading, going on, you know, in the chambers between the judges than one might think, because you know, on a panel of three, if you're the one and it's a 2-to-1 vote, and you're really passionate about your position, I would think you might be tempted to go and try to persuade one of your colleagues to come join your side.
It's so true, Todd. And one of the many great, great things about this process, and I really believe it, is we all do that. We all feel sometimes so strongly that we have the legally correct view and our colleagues are wrong. I've had this happen many times, and I will go and passionately, just happened recently, where I passionately and vigorously try to convince my two colleagues that they are making a big legal mistake. And then we get to discussing it. And a couple of hours will go by, we'll go back and forth, and a light bulb will go off of my head. And I realize I'm the one that's wrong. And and that has happened to me a lot. You know, sometimes it doesn't happen immediately. I remember a time where I had just exactly this happen. It was my first year on the court, and we had a passionate discussion about it. And on the plane ride back from Denver, I had that light bulb go off, and I got back at 8 o'clock the next morning. I emailed my two colleagues and said, you know, on the flight back to Oklahoma City, I finally figured out what you guys had been saying all along to me. And I completely agree with your view. I couldn't have completely changed my mind. Sometimes it happens, you know, during the drafting process. But one of the things that all of my colleagues have in common is a really wonderful talent and ability to listen to one another. And, you know, we all have egos, we all have pride, but we all, I think, are aware of the fact that it's really not about us. It's trying to get the decision and the analysis correct in every case. And if that means we have to eat crow and say, you know, I've drafted this 40-page dissent and I'm throwing it in the trash can because on the fifth round of editing that I see now, these revisions in the majority opinion are correct, and I'm going to discard my dissent and join the majority opinion. I've seen that with all of my colleagues, the ability and willingness to do that. And it's really, you know, quite extraordinary.
I feel like that's one of the things as an appellate lawyer and counseling appellate clients that's so hard to express, because from our perspective, we write the briefs, maybe we have oral argument, and then it sort of goes into a box that you can't see inside of. And then at some point in the future, you get an opinion out. And what we miss is all of the things that go on behind the scenes, that maybe it wasn't initially a 3-0 opinion, or maybe it was a 2-1 opinion going a different direction. And we really do miss the sort of back and forth and the editing and the drafting that come up with the final polished opinion that ends up in front of us.
That's so true, Jody. And I wish it weren't the case, because I really do believe that lawyers and the public generally would have an even greater appreciation for the process. I'm not saying the individual judges, and of course we're all fallible and we all make mistakes, but at least they would see that we are sincerely trying to get it right. You know, we're not, you know, saying, well, the plaintiff needs to win because the plaintiff has the moral high ground in this case. You know, we are diving into the weeds. What does this case say? And what did the parties argue, and we may have differing interpretations of what the arguments are. And I wish there was a way for lawyers and the public to have a window into the processes, because I think that the appreciation for the process would be enhanced if that were the case.
I think the description that you gave of that process really illustrates the difference between your last two jobs. Is, you know, as a magistrate, if you're on the bench making rulings, you know, you've got to make a relatively quick ruling right then and there. But the process of, you know, going through the draft revisions and trying to persuade your colleagues, that's the reason I think why appellate courts don't issue their decisions from the bench.
So, yeah, you called it. You hit it on the head, Todd. That's exactly right.
Well, we've talked on the show before about how if you've got clients who attend oral arguments, sometimes they don't understand, you know, how the timeline works and that it could take a long time to get a decision. They're used to the trial judge who maybe did issue a ruling either on the bench or shortly after, and they get conditioned, I think, to all courts ruling that way. But we know, the three of us sitting here talking, that that can't be the way it is, because it just, you know, you can't make sure to use that thoughtfulness to make sure that the law is being faithfully applied to the facts, or even more importantly, that you're getting the law right in the first place, because sometimes it's just not that clear.
That's so true, Todd. And I'll tell you one thing about our court, and I hope this isn't a secret. I don't think it is, but our court is, I think, unique of all the circuit courts. When we have a published opinion, we circulate it to every judge in our circuit, not just the, you know, the panel has already cast their votes, and we have maybe a majority opinion and a dissent, or majority opinion and concurrence. And then those opinions get circulated to all of the judges. And it's the idea is that, and this is just for published opinions, that if other judges in our court are going to be bound by this now as precedent, they ought to be able to voice their input to the judges on the panel. And we all do that frequently. And so sometimes the majority may have decided something, and it may end up costing delay. And that's really is an unfortunate consequence. And we do try to remind ourselves of the need to decide expeditiously. And that is frankly one downside of our process, is it does add to the delay. But that too provides a further safeguard that, you know, maybe we're still going to make a mistake, but hopefully if we do make a mistake, other judges outside the panel may help us to recognize that and may help us think through something. And we get very, very thoughtful comments from, we call them off-panel members.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today. Transitioning a little bit, one of the reasons that you're on this podcast today is that you have written a book, and the book is called Legal Writing, A Judge's Perspective on the Science and Rhetoric of the Written Word. One of the things that's, I think, most impressive is I don't think I've ever met a federal judge that said they didn't have enough to do already, and you found time to write a book. How did this idea come to you?
When I joined the court, and I should say, Jody, that I've always really enjoyed legal writing. And when I became a magistrate judge, I thought I was a good writer, but I knew that I could be a better writer. And so I started studying legal writing books, trying to improve myself in that regard, because that was a large part of my job. When I became a circuit judge, I had even a greater awareness that my words will matter as they did before, but not just to the parties, to other lawyers in other cases. And my words are going to have a ripple effect. They're going to be having influences and can be interpreted for purposes that I really couldn't even foresee. And I thought it was extremely important for me to try to better myself as a legal writer and become more sensitive to my words and how to utilize words and put together pieces of information. And frankly, I started writing a legal writing book as a self-help measure. I thought if I disciplined myself to actually write my own original thoughts about legal writing, it will force me to intensify my study of materials that others before me have written to enhance my own legal writing ability. And then as I did that, tried to open myself, because there's hundreds and hundreds of legal writing books. And I thought, you know, I don't want to just say the same thing other people have said. And I learned about an area known as psycholinguistics, the psychologists that study cognition and fluency. As legal writers, all of us, you, Todd, myself, we all think about our audience. You might think about if you're writing to the say, the Fifth Circuit or County District Court, whoever the judges are, you're going to be thinking about their reaction to the way that you put together pieces of information. You may think about it in terms of the length of the brief or whether to have a screen cite, a variety of strategic decisions. And these psychologists are taking the things that we have done for decades through a matter of intuition, and they have actually been doing empirical studies on how the brain processes language. So now, when you think about your audience, you can dive into the minutiae and think, okay, well, when a judge reads a particular paragraph that takes up the better part of a page, does it affect the judge's reading speed? Does it affect the judge's ability to comprehend that paragraph if it's not broken up into shorter paragraphs or the way sentences are put together? And so I really tried to learn as much as I could from psycholinguistics and try to apply those principles, not as an academic exercise, but try to draw practical lessons for us as legal writers of how you put together a sentence, how you link information in sentences, how you create context, how you paragraph, what font do you use, what considerations in deciding whether to use fonts or visual images do you utilize, and try to draw from these lessons that these cognitive psychologists have paved the way for. And then I also tried to think creatively about other forms of communication. These masterful speeches from orators of our past, like JFK, or FDR, Winston Churchill, Martin Luther King. What is it about the way that they delivered speeches? Now, it was oral communication, not written communication generally, but what is it about the way that they delivered and put together pieces of information that captivated us so? Why was JFK so captivating as a speaker? And so I really tried to dive into those speeches from famous orators of our past, and those were four of the principal subjects of my studies, and try to extract lessons that we can all derive that we can apply in our written communication. And I don't think it's coincidental that there was largely an overlay between the lessons that cognitive psychologists have drawn and the lessons that these orators have illustrated in their speeches. Oftentimes, even though JFK and FDR were not psycholinguists and didn't know anything about psycholinguistics, it's amazing that if you look at the lessons that were drawn from psycholinguistics, the way that they applied maybe intuitively exactly those same principles in their speeches. And I thought all of us really could derive some practical everyday advice in how we put together information by drawing on these two resources, psycholinguistics and oratory.
Are there things that you learned putting this together that kind of surprised you or maybe changed the way that you approached legal writing?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I always thought is, you know, if you have a sophisticated vocabulary, if you use $64 words, that you signal intelligence, you signal to the reader, maybe even implicitly, that you're using more precise language. There's a psychologist, cognitive psychologist at now Carnegie Mellon, it used to be Princeton, Daniel Oppenheimer, that conducted these studies when he was doing doctoral work at Stanford. And he did, he published a paper in 2006. And I'll give you an illustration that I think was really surprising. He took six essays that were written by applicants for the graduate school in the Department of English at Stanford. And he took 71 undergrads at Stanford. And he took these essays that were really written in very simple prose, and he would give call that the original version. And then he would take every third content word and make it a more protracted word. And then he would change every content word and make it a bigger word. And he gave it to these 71 undergrads and asked them, well, which do you prefer? Which would you rank second? Which would you rank third? And not surprisingly, perhaps, the undergrads, by and large, rated the simplest prose the best, moderate complexity second best, and the most complex the third best. What was shocking to me was when he asked the second question, and that is, which of these students should be admitted to the graduate school? Overwhelming margin, they said their answers mirrored the answers to the first question, that the authors of the simplest prose should be admitted. The ones that were least likely were the ones that used the longer words, that they were the least meritorious applicants. He did other studies. He used two translations from a Meditation 4 from Descartes, the philosopher. And there was one that by Twayman, I believe, that was rated as simpler prose than the translation by another translator named Heffernan. And so he asked another group at Stanford, which is the more intelligent individual? And he told half the group that it was written by Descartes. He told half the group that it was anonymously authored. And in both groups, they rated the intelligence of the simpler translation as more intelligent than the other, than whoever had written the other work. And this was also replicated in two other studies. So what was, I think one of, I was surprised by many, many things, Jody, but one of the things that so surprised me was that the empirical work really does seem to demonstrate that our intuition as legal writers of using simple language is actually doesn't carry the drawback of signaling maybe a lesser intelligence. His studies show that precisely the opposite is true, that it actually enhances the perspective of the author by using simple prose. And that was, frankly, somewhat of a shocking revelation to me.
Isn't that interesting? I wanted to ask you about how visual images fit into this, but it sounds like maybe it goes more into the psycholinguistics sort of side. But what did you learn more specifically about the effectiveness of visual images in legal writing? Because we've seen more of that in recent years, and we've a previous guest on our show, Mark Trachtenberg, who's a friend of ours, has written a lot about that. And so have a few other people. Seems like it's more commonly in use now.
It is more commonly in use. It'll be, I think, increasingly common the further we go and in future years. I think it is absolutely wonderful. It is, you know, I left litigation in early 1999. And even then, there was never a case that I remember being a part of that would go to trial where at least one, and frankly, in almost all cases, both lawyers would use visual aids for the jury, for the fact finder. For some reason, many of us grew up thinking, well, you don't do that in a brief. It's supposed to be more stale. It's supposed to be drier. And if you're describing the layout, say, of a house, and where the officer went to search various rooms, or describing the search of a car, how is it that people think that you can simply dryly describe what took place just as effectively without a visual aid? You're describing something that by its definition is visual. You're enticing the reader to draw a visual image in his or her head. So why not give them the accurate visual image so that they can see what exactly took place? There was a case, and I wish I could remember the name of it, that Judge Posner had written for the Seventh Circuit when he was sitting on the Seventh Circuit. And he was describing, it was a First Amendment case, I believe, involving a march through downtown Chicago. Well, I don't know. I've been in downtown Chicago, but I don't know the street names and the like. And so he, in prose, described the route that the protesters took and where they were isolated to their designated protest area. But he accompanied that with a visual image that he got off of Google Maps, and he drew an arrow. And if you read the prose without that map, I defy anybody, unless you are from downtown Chicago, to be able to visualize that path. But once you have that path visually in front of you, it becomes very, very easy. And I think visual images are very, very much underutilized resource in brief writing.
It makes me think about when you're looking at an exhibit or you're looking at an appellate record and trying to correspond the two. When you have a witness, you know, you're looking at defendant's exhibit 5. Yes. So where would this happen? Right here. What about that? Right there. What about this? Yep, that was right there by that thing. And then, you know, as the judge or the advocate, you're looking at the picture going, okay, well, this doesn't help me much.
That's such a great example, Joey.
While we're on the subject of oratory just a little bit, you know, I know that you have kind of focused on legal writing and the written word, but what about oral arguments? Do some of these lessons apply equally to oral argument?
To some extent, but I really think that oral argument is just a different beast. In oral argument, the by far the most important principle is to just answer the judge's questions. And that's really, in my view, the only reason for oral argument. And I don't mean to minimize the importance of oral argument. To the contrary, it's changed my mind in a lot of cases, and I think it's very, very important. But we've all read the briefs. We've studied the cases. We've studied the record, all of us, when we go to oral argument. So if a lawyer is simply regurgitating what's in the briefs, that's not going to be terribly helpful. When I was in private practice, he's deceased now, but there was a state judge who would begin every oral argument. This is in county district court. And he would say, well, I'll hear from, the plaintiff or whoever, the movement. But don't tell me what's in your briefs. And I used to always have such anxiety appearing before that judge because I thought, you know, if I thought it was a good point, I would have put it in my brief. So I'm really not sure what I would be okay if you hadn't restricted me in that way. So, but there's a lot of truth to that. You know, so you get up and what else are you going to say? It's in your brief. But the judges are going to, you know, maybe it's going to be a stupid question, but this is the time to educate the judge. You know, you don't need to say, judge, that is a stupid question. Although I've had plenty of people tell me that, you know, but that is an opportunity to educate, you know, the court. It's not our case. We're trying our hardest to understand it and to analyze it. And, you know, maybe we completely agree with what you're saying, but are really trying to make sure that we're not going astray from the law by adopting your view. And maybe we're trying to explore how far the principle will extend. And so it's almost impossible really to know exactly why the judges are asking the questions. But what is important is just really trying to listen to the judge's questions, which is so difficult. I know from my experience, you know, when you appear in court, I always got nervous. I still get nervous as a judge. And when you have anxiety, it's more difficult truly to listen. And it's so tempting knowing that you're going to be expected to give a meaningful, intelligent response in a second when the judge is formulating his or her question to be trying to formulate in your mind your answer. But what that does is impede your ability to actually listen to the question. And so it's a very difficult process to actually listen without thinking about what your answer is going to be. And before giving a meaningful answer. But that's by far the most important. A lot of the things that from legal writing that we can do by editing ourselves and others dozens and dozens and dozens of times, well, it's really too much to expect ourselves to be able to do that momentarily in oral argument. And so I think a lot of the lessons for legal writing really can't be applied in a meaningful way to oral argument.
You talked about, though, you know, studying the great speech makers like JFK or Churchill. You know, the lesson isn't we need to all be as great as they were standing behind the lectern. But did you consider in your book, say, like nonverbal kind of cues, like, you know, how to project or posture yourselves to be effective as an advocate?
Not really, to be honest with you. Todd's great question, but I really didn't focus too much on oral communication, except as it applies to trying to derive lessons for our legal writing. And so, yeah, so I really didn't delve too much into oral delivery.
Well, based on the book's title, I think that makes a lot of sense, since you talk specifically about this being about the science and rhetoric of the written word. But I was intrigued by what you said about the pattern of great communication, written form, carrying through into oral delivery as well.
There's a, you know, for example, if you look at one of the examples in the book is about the idea of chunking information. Many of us in high school were told, keep our sentences short, keep them to 20, 25 words. Martin Luther King Jr. in Letter from Birmingham Jail has one sentence that is 305 words. Now think of it, 305 words. I could write a 305 words and myself, much less have anybody else understand it. But Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't just a brilliant oral communicator. He was a master at putting together pieces of information. And what cognitive psychologists tell us is that we don't process information a sentence at a time. We process information a chunk at a time, which they refer to as a familiar unit of information. It could be a sound, a clause. If you think about our telephone number, we write it in the area code, you know, one chunk, the first three digits in parentheses. It's visually segregated so we can see where the chunk starts and stops. We see the three-digit prefix before another piece of punctuation, a dash, and four digits after it. And psychologists that study cognition tell us that's actually how you process information, how all readers process information. And again, I'm not suggesting that Martin Luther King Jr. was a psycholinguist, but if you look at that one sentence, what he does is he puts that 305-word sentence together through 12 chunks of information. The first chunk is, but when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim. And then he has a semicolon. So you know when you are reading it that he has a forced pause. This is one chunk, one unit of information that we will process. And we will, when we're talking about visual images, we will visualize what he said in that first chunk in our heads, whether we want to or not. We just do it. And then he goes to a second chunk. When you've seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, and he does it for 10 more, what I call chunks of information. And so this is one of the illustrations, I think, where these masterful oral communicators are not just masters at the way that they can orally deliver information. There was also a mastery of how they put together particular pieces of information. His messages would have been gobbledygook if people couldn't understand it. You know, if it was 305-word sentence without any punctuation, without any visual separators of where the chunks of information start and stop, we would just be scratching our heads and saying, I have no idea what he's talking about. Nobody is going to read this sentence, despite its extraordinary length, and have any difficulty in comprehending it. It's just a masterful piece of oratory. But for purposes of our legal writing, it's more than that. It's an illustration of how we can apply exactly the same principles of putting together chunks of information in our briefs, our memoranda to senior partners, to colleagues, letters to clients, in a way that our readers, whether it's the client, adversary, co-counsel, whoever it is, will be able to process that information. And that's what I'm really referring to, is just these types of illustrations of how these orators have put together information.
I guess I've got one more book to add to my reading list now.
I hope so.
Very interesting. And I love the topic. I love the title. And you can bet that it'll be finding its way onto my bookshelf and hopefully to my nightstand or my reading chair where I will consume it, because I love what you did with it in terms of bringing together the scientific aspects of it and then tying it to oratory, and all with the goal of analyzing, you know, what is persuasive legal writing and effective legal writing.
Well, and it's kind of neat that we live in a time where the science actually catches up with the art of legal writing, because legal writing is really kind of always been an art, but there is a science to it. And I love that you have captured that component of it and draw practical empirical lessons that go along with what's always just sort of been taught as kind of a gut feeling of whether it makes sense or not. And so I very much appreciate that.
I so agree, Jody, and I appreciate your kind words and Todd's. You know, many years ago, a couple of decades ago, one of the law clerks for another judge was going off, and I think it was at one of these lunches, and I was asking this individual what they were going to do after their clerkship, and they said they were going to teach legal writing. And I thought, what an odd thing to do. How do you teach legal writing? And this shows my naivete at that time. And she said, well, there are books about it. And I said, you've got to be kidding. And I had no idea. And that was my exposure to it. And, you know, when I was, like I mentioned earlier, I graduated law school in 1985. I just don't, I'm sure there were a ton of legal writing books, but I just had no idea of this resource that was available. And now there's, you know, these great resources available to us to enhance our abilities. And that's just one of the great things I think about being a lawyer at this point in our lives.
Before we kind of wrap up here, I wanted to tell people where they could get your book. And it's published by the ABA Press, and you can get it through their website, correct?
That's right. You can get it through their website or call the 800 number for ABA Press.
And the title again, I know I said it earlier, but it's Legal Writing, A Judge's Perspective on the Science and Rhetoric of the Written Word. And we can give the discount code, Judge, if you'd like us to. We don't have to. We have it. You tell me.
Well, that would be wonderful if you all, it's up to you all, but speak back with me.
We're happy to do that. I'll do it here and then say that we're going to drop it in the show notes, and Todd, we can kind of edit this little part out. And there is a discount code that you can use through the end of the year to get a 20% discount on it. We'll drop it in our show notes as well, but I'll go ahead and say it here. It's the letters L as in legal, G as in gold, L as in legal, F as in Frank, B as in boy, R as in red, A as in apple. So that's LGLFBRA when you're using the ABA website for 20% off. And thank you for sharing that with us, Judge, as well. I know our listeners will appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. And Jody, thank you and Todd for having me. It's just a delight to be with you all.
Absolutely. This has been fantastic. Well, before we go and wrap up finally, we always like to ask our guests for a tip or a war story. And you've given some great ones. I don't know if you have another one you'd like to share, but we always like to give the opportunity if you do.
Well, there was I'll tell a war story. It's not my war story, but I mentioned that this judge who's now deceased, Lee West, and this happened. He was a federal district judge for decades and decades. And early in his, I think it was early in his judgeship, he had a criminal defendant who, when the outcome was announced, and the defendant wasn't particularly pleased with the outcome, it was a criminal case, he stood up on counsel table and urinated.
Oh, gosh.
On counsel table. And we had a memorial service recently after the pandemic, and one of his longtime, the judge's longtime friends mentioned, I forget the fellow's name, the defendant, but mentioned that he was just such a hero of his.
That truly is a war story.
That is a war story.
I've never had that happen in my own experience.
Let's hope you don't have it happen.
Yeah, hopefully not.
Circuit.
I don't know if you all want to put that in your podcast, but
I think we can leave that in. That's a pretty interesting one.
Hey, you know, never let it be said that the practice of law or judging for that matter is boring.
That is true. That's very true.
Judge Bacharach, it's been a pleasure to visit with you.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate this.
Thank you all. I just thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.